Hello, welcome to Blogging Heads. I'm Tim Carney, the senior political columnist at Washington Examiner, and I'm here with Tim Noah at Slate. Sorry, Tim, your title
I'm
at Slate.
Senior writer at Slate.
So we're very senior crew here.
We are very senior. We are senior citizens here.
Tim, I want you to start by explaining to me and all the viewers just what is going on in Egypt.
Well, I think I could summarize that by saying I don't know, and that I think is the the lesson. I think the accumulating lesson of the coverage is that it is very hard to know sort of what's true. Obviously, it's events are changing on the ground. It seemed absolutely crystal clear a couple of days ago that Mubarak was going to be pushed out, and the White House even seemed to be making noises that sounded like that, although I think they never actually said it explicitly. The thrust of what they were saying mm-hmm. seemed to be, let's get him out of there. Starting yesterday, the message from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was, whoa, not so fast. We need to, if we're going to arrange a transition to an orderly government where rule of law prevails, then we need a little more time and we need to work with the vice president. That seems to be changing yet again today as we're reading. The crowds are once again massing in the streets, apparently very energized by a TV appearance made by the Google executive who mm-hmm. was taken into custody, who had helped start these protests. I think it's an occasion to express humility about our ability to understand
exactly.
events. I mean, Mubarak really looked, I have to say, a couple of days ago, I was scratching my head wondering why is Mubarak the only guy in the entire world who doesn't know he has to leave right
yeah.
away? But then, yesterday I thought, well, maybe he knows something I don't know. And today I'm not so sure.
And part of today I liked the Pat Buchanan column on this, which just said, look, there seems to be a clash here between American interests and American ideals. The sort of George Bush talk of freedom is not just God's gift to America, but the Almighty's gift to all of mankind. And then you realize the reason Mubarak is there and the reason he's as strong as he is the aid that we've provided him, because he was helpful in the Cold War. He was helpful in protecting Israel's very existence. And as far as I know, he's been helpful in fighting against Al-Qaeda. And so,
the blunt truth is that the United States government was perfectly happy to see him maintain anti-democratic policies so long as he was able to keep the lid on.
Yeah, it was about, and foreign policy is often very Nietzschean, I feel like. I feel like the sort of scruples and the principles and the sort of unjust means that we might not use in other aspects of domestic policy or personal lives or anything, when it comes to foreign policy, I think we sort of broadly accept that there will be simple, pure pragmatism without much concern for principle, and that I think a conservative philosophical insight is that sort of Edmund Burke type stuff here, is that when you deviate from principle because you say, oh, well, I need to attain this particular goal, it's hubris. You don't know what the consequences of your actions are going to be. Is Iran better off today because we backed the Shah? Or better question, is the United States better off today because we backed the Shah? Or are we going to be better off in 5 years because we backed Mubarak? And just for the simple fact that they were oppressed by somebody who was backed by the United States means it's entirely possible that the Egyptian people are going to dislike us and their government is going to be an anti-American government. And if that just means that they dislike us, I don't mind. If that means that there are elements in their government that are giving aid and comfort to terrorists, well, then that matters. And then it may have proven to be a mistake. So for me, it's another lesson in humility. It's these entangling alliances can have long-term unforeseen consequences.
Right. And you know, just at an emotional level, it is difficult not to respond favorably to mobs of people on the street peacefully demanding their freedom. You know, one wants to believe that, that a peaceful transition can be made. And I just am very reluctant to make any pronouncements about what's going to happen here. I think it could go a million different ways. And I'm crossing my fingers that Egypt will end up with a reasonably democratic, reasonably secular, or at least non-terrorist government.
But I have a question, and you can take this as a rhetorical question, or you can try to answer it. But did Iran in the early days of their 1979 revolution, did they look like Egypt now? Did they look a lot different? Did we think at any points there?
I sort of seem to recall that it was kind of a Menshevik-like period where moderates were in control, and then they lost control to the Ayatollah. I'm trying to remember the guys. There was a guy, I'm not going to remember his name, but he was sort of a Kerensky-like figure. And I mean, that is the great fear, is that moderate revolutions quickly evolve into extremist revolutions.
Into Robespierre and into Cromwell and into Stalin.
Right. But then, of course, we have the United States.
Yes.
Which
we may have exhausted our what we have to say on Egypt. But I have a segue here, which is that there is a Lebanese American member of Congress, and that's Daryl Issa. I got that right, right? He's Lebanese.
I think that's right.
Yes. So that's sort of like a Mideast thing. And you have a blog post or an article on Slate about ISA's gambit sending out to business leaders about regulations and what they like and what they don't like. So people can obviously read your article, but what do you think is the most important thing coming from this story?
Well, my the point I wanted to make was that I mean, I sort of find ISA's premise wrong. I mean, ISA's stance is that business is being crushed by too much regulation, and that this is killing jobs, and that therefore we need to consult business, find out what these regulations are that business doesn't like, and address their concerns. And what I wrote was, in effect, since when has Washington not listened very hard to businesses' concerns? Under both Democrats and Republicans, much of the business of Washington consists of finding out what business wants and giving it to them. The Democrats are a smidgen less responsive than the Republicans. I cite the example of when you just think about how regulations are written in the first place.
Periods, which is
an
not,
agency
you know,
right, puts out a proposed rule, and there is a comment period where the public may respond. And as I sort of pointed out, the public in this instance is business. I mean, this, you know, have you ever written a comment on a proposed regulation?
But I'll tell you, the people I know who have done it who have ghostwritten these comments, where say Microsoft will hire a lobbying firm. And then if Microsoft hears from some, you know, Mary Johnson in Tacoma, Washington, oh, well, I like what you're doing and I don't like what the government's doing, then Microsoft will get this consulting firm or PR firm and to write a letter in Mary Johnson's name, send it to Mary Johnson, have her sign off on it, and then it goes in the public comment thing. So I know that
I consider myself a hardened Washingtonian, but I had not heard about that particular con before.
Oh, yeah. No, and I use
sort
Microsoft.
Sock puppet. They basically sock puppet, to use internet phraseology.
Yeah, except I think sock puppets are made up people. These are real people who are being sort of identified and ghostwritten for. And obviously,
are these real
point
people
out that,
compensated in any way for their time?
No, I don't think so. The ghostwriter is. But
what a sweet gig.
Yeah, the lobbying, in addition to the regulatory process where business has a big impact, just the plain old lobbying of Congress between the time the idea is floated and the bill becomes a law. And then there are sort of unofficial ways in which business influences the regulatory process. So I think you're right. And part of the problem with what ICE is doing is that when you are trying to find who is suffering from regulations, a lot of time it's businesses that don't exist because that regulation is there. And your piece in Slate, I got to admit, I read the subhead, which was "Surprise, Business Doesn't Like Regulation," and I was about to tear out my hair because I know that you know better. I've read stuff you've written about business supporting regulation that kills smaller competition. Sure enough, you included it in your piece. And it's not just the licensing laws you refer to. There's lots of regulation that either drives profit to businesses or kill smaller businesses, thus benefiting bigger businesses.
Right.
So those smaller businesses,
like, there are times when a regulation will you know, one kind of business will like a regulation and another kind of business won't.
But to go back to sort of the structure of what's ICE trying to do, I like what he's trying to do. But again, one problem here is some of the businesses that are hurt by this don't exist because they couldn't come in and they couldn't compete because of the regulatory barriers to entry. Another type of people who are hurt by bad regulations are consumers or businesses that are small enough and diverse enough and scattered enough that there's no way to sort of reach out to them well. You can only do so much of a listening tour to get out there. I think conservatives ought to just say, look, this is a regulatory burden which impoverishes us, which unjustly infringes on consensual commerce, and which doesn't really serve a public interest. So trying to go out and reach to business, partly for the reasons you state, and partly because it's difficult to really get at some of the victims of regulation. And I think you had a particularly cynical read where you said this might just be sort of ISA painting himself as trying to, you know, get lots of big business contacts to donate to Republicans or something. But I want to know if you think something similar is happening with Obama, because I don't think his sort of new pro-business outreach is anything different substance-wise, or it's not very different substance-wise than what he's always stood for.
I agree, and I agree, but I think that, but I agree mainly because I think that this rap against Obama that he's anti-business is essentially false.
Yeah, he's just anti-free market. He's not anti-business.
Well, I'd be interested to hear your argument about that. How is he pro-business and anti-free market?
He's pro-subsidy. You look at his State of the Union address. It was also in his address to the Commerce Department. I'm going to go around. I promise you this. He said, "I will go anywhere and do whatever it takes to sell American products overseas." So that's not free trade. That's sort of.
How is that different from what every president has done, at least going?
Yeah, it's not, but it's simultaneously pro-business, and it's not about opening doors so that businesses can do deals. It's about going and saying, and George Bush, there's a WikiLeaks thing, George Bush sent a letter to the King of Saudi Arabia saying, you really ought to buy this Boeing jet. And so when Bush was doing that, and when Obama was doing this, this was not sort of laissez-faire economics, and this was not free trade. This was our government actively working to help Boeing. And there's all sorts of different motivations. Creates jobs, good for the economy, helping your corporate buddies, whatever. But that's what's going on. You've also got Obama, you look at his Obamacare, where the drug industry was entirely on board. He got the American Medical Association and the American Hospital Association also on board with what he was doing, because he was throwing subsidies, mandates that benefited them their way, and the cap and trade.
Well, actually, I think the main thing my main objection with how Obama dealt with the drug companies wasn't so much the subsidies as it was the
importation,
the relief from competition,
and the 12-year on bio pharmaceuticals, high tech drugs.
Yes, that was
12-year exclusivity.
That was definitely disgraceful, but you know
and none of those are pro free market, and all of those are pro big business and cap and trade. I'm sure you know how.
Before we get away from the drug companies, though, I just want to be clear. My main objection there is that the government was not allowed to. I mean, one of the big problems with the Medicare expansion under George W. Bush was that the government was forbidden to negotiate volume discounts.
Prices.
And that is, you know, that was that very idea was kind of denounced as being anti-competitive, but it's not. It's just sort of the logic of the market that if you scale up, you acquire greater leverage, and you ought to be able to exercise it. You're perverting the market if the big buyer is not allowed to do that.
No,
especially if the big buyer is acting in the public interest, it's absurd to limit the government's ability to bid down the price of.
And Obama had
he gave that away. That was disgraceful.
He had a campaign ad which was called Billy, and that's Billy Tozan. In which he said, oh, well, you know, when the Republicans were writing the prescription drug bill, one of the committee chairmen who wrote the bill, as soon as it passed, he left, started making $2 million a year as a drug lobbyist, and after putting in there that the Medicare can't negotiate down prices with the drug company. And I thought that was great. When I saw that during the primary, I saw Hillary as being sort of the person who was into cronyism, and when Obama was talking that way before Iowa, I thought, this is great. He's taking on cronyism. And then, sure enough, Billy Tozan got a seat right there at the table in the White House, in the West Wing, Rahm Emanuel and other people, and he protected the, as you said, the reimportation. He protected the no negotiation. They got subsidies and handouts. They got 12 years on the biotech drugs. And again, every one of these things was pro- business, if the business you're talking about is a drug industry. I mean, this is sort of my whole shtick, is Obama, in different ways, but as much as Bush, is a corporatist, where he uses big business, he uses big government to steer while he lets big business row the ship. He is not saying, he's not a socialist, that Marxist who wants to nationalize industry, but he's also not a laissez-faire free market guy like Rachel Maddow says.
He is no more of a corporatist than you know his immediate six predecessors.
I feel like Gerald Ford is the winner if we go back. Honestly, I wrote a book, The Big Ripoff, in 2006, and I had a chapter on sort of the history of corporatism in the second half of the 20th century, and I had great examples and tons of them for every president. And then with Gerald Ford, I couldn't find it.
Really?
Nixon had done these wage and price controls that a lot of the business industry was on board with, and maybe I just didn't look hard. And there's lots of reasons for conservatives and liberals to dislike Gerald Ford, but on my own pet topic of corporatism, Gerald Ford, you know, if I got to rank presidents of the 20th century, so far he's number one. Maybe I don't know why, but
this should be noted at the. Have you ever been? I was last year for the first time in Grand Rapids. I had a chance to go to the Gerald Ford Presidential Museum. Have you ever been there?
No, I've never been to Grand Rapids.
It's a little tiny museum because he was only president for 2.5 years.
Yeah,
and they you go there, even though it's a little tiny museum, they really are struggling to think of things to talk about there. So you should tell them.
I should help them make an exhibit. Yes, on the non-corporatist president.
They had to like have a room that was all about like the 60s, even though he wasn't president until the 70s. And they had a room about the 70s, even though he was only president for part of the 70s.
The very
end. And they were kind of desperate.
But the broader issue here is, I mean, not the broader issue, to go back to the political question, I talked to some Goldman Sachs lobbyists who told me that the bankers they talked to who had been Democrats, supported Obama in 08, and then supported Republicans in 2010, Goldman Sachs lobbyists assumed that they were upset about Dodd-Frank. But then they said, well, no, we can deal with these regulations. We can adjust to them. It was just the way he was calling us all these names, calling us fat cats, attacking us, making us be the bad guys. And you're just thinking, wow, if that's all it takes to win these. Hey, you should have thicker skin. I feel like I've got decently thick skin, and if I made five times as much money, I'd have even thicker skin maybe. But maybe it's the other way around when you look at a guy like Dan Snyder, and maybe money makes you have thinner skin. But so my question here is,
well, I think
is Obama
just used to winning. They're not used to losing.
Yeah. And so it was Obama just changing his rhetoric because he knows that his rhetoric was what drove him away. If he changes his rhetoric, he can win them back. Will he set records for raising money from Wall Street in 2008? Will he do it again in 2012? I really look forward to seeing those numbers.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting. I mean, I my own feeling is that Dodd-Frank, like the healthcare reform law, was really kind of an opening bid in in what's going to need to be a succession of laws that in the case of Dodd-Frank, get the financial sector under control.
So there will be continued engagement between Obama and Wall Street, and I promise you, we will not all be sort of as contentious as it was in those few weeks when, the SEC case against Goldman came out. Obama was using the words fat cats. Again, I think that was mostly rhetoric, and his talk now is, I don't see much of a substantive shift. However, he was talking about tax reform and cutting corporate taxes while getting rid of loopholes, something I would see as a positive development, and I think that's new, at least because he attacked John McCain for cutting corporate taxes during the campaign.
So you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I'm suddenly realizing that I have not heard any discussion since the State of the Union of Obama's wanting to cut subsidies to oil and gas industries. Is it because it's just assumed that's never going to happen in a million years? It's purely rhetorical?
Well, the subsidy thing, I was actually talking to an oil guy, a Texas oil guy, the other day, and I said, what are all the subsidies you get? Because this was, it was free market. Oh, I don't like all these subsidies. Da da da. I want to be able to drill more. I said, what are the subsidies you get? And he said, the first one that Obama goes after has to do with income made in overseas operations. Just, it's not something that applies to oil companies, but applies to all international companies. And something about the nature of drilling might mean it particularly benefits oil companies. But that's sort of a multinational corporation tax break, more than it's an oil subsidy. Then there's something that's confusing that I do have to figure out called the depletion allowance, where somehow as the
oil
wells... I've
been trying for 30 years to understand the oil depletion allowance.
These guys are drilling and there's lots of oil there. And when they get the oil out, well, they get to deduct the fact that there's not as much oil in the underground anymore. It's something like that, which
it's
might
sort
make
of like
some
depreciation,
sense.
I think. I don't really know.
But the fact of the matter is there's not... There, and then there are some tax credits sometimes if there's a well that's mostly drilled and there's just a tiny bit left down there, but it's not economical to get the last bit, sometimes the government says, all right, we won't tax you on that last bit. So the fact of the matter is oil and gas subsidies, yes, I want them to all go away to the degree that it's corporate welfare distorting the market, but there isn't that much there if you're really talking about favors for the oil industry, and certainly it's dwarfed as in its importance to the industry. It's dwarfed by all the ethanol, all the nuclear. I mean, not nuclear so much, but ethanol, solar, all the alternative fuels. They are subsidized proportionally to their industries much more than oil is.
Alternative energy is subsidized to a greater extent than oil. I have to say,
The dollar amount is bigger. The dollar amount is probably bigger for oil.
It would almost have to be bigger because oil is
so much bigger. Well, think about it. Would corn ethanol exist without subsidies? Maybe in a very limited way. Solar, wind, at this point, if you pulled the plug on some of the wind subsidies, maybe they would exist, but I don't think it would keep building up and wouldn't have built up in the first place. So all these alternative fuels. Oh, and it's another inconsistency on Obama is that he says, oh, well, I want to simplify the tax code, but he's throwing out these, tax credits for green energy here, permanent R&D tax credit there. So I don't think he really does want to simplify the tax code.
No, and I actually, my response to that is thank goodness he doesn't want to simplify the tax code because I've written this in the past. I might even have mentioned it on Blogging Heads before, and if I have, I apologize. But, the fallacy in the thinking about taxes is that this is just like 1986. 1986, the one domestic initiative that Ronald Reagan enacted that was cheered by both liberals and conservatives was tax reform in 1986. And it was a trade that in exchange for reducing the number of brackets from something like 14 to I forget how many, maybe 3 or 4. And also in exchange for bringing the top rate down, a lot of loopholes were closed. And the problem this time out, which I think has gone unrecognized, is we don't have the same situation in 2011. We don't have that many tax brackets now. I think we only have, 4 or 5 or something, right? Or 6 mm-hmm. maybe. And the top rate is not very high. It's well below 40%. So it's not a good trade. The other thing.
Well, and he's talking here specifically about corporate taxes.
Hmm?
Yeah, I think he's here talking about particularly about corporate taxes.
No, he was talking about. He's been talking about simplifying income taxes.
Okay.
And the other thing that's happened in the last 25 years is that we've had expanding income inequality, particularly since the 90s at the top end. And so it has become increasingly absurd to treat everybody who earns more than $250,000 as being in the same category. Mm-hmm. I am not pleading for lowering taxes on people who make $250,000, $250,000 and over. I think that should be raised the way Obama wanted to raise it. But I also think that in addition to that, something that wasn't even discussed is that we need to lay in some new brackets, at least 3 or 4 above that one, to capture these incomes
that are astronomical.
The very, very high end.
The people who make the $250,000 earners look poor.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I'm ready to take part of your deal, but I'm going to make a counter offer here.
Okay.
If you get rid of a lot of the subsidies, the tax credits and the deductions and the exemptions, the way that politicians try to use a tax code to steer behavior, you will help the economy. Because instead of, as Obama said yesterday before the Chamber of Commerce, too many businesses are making their decisions not based on where they think is the most value, but on what their tax advisor says. If you get rid of all of those for business and for individuals, that will help the economy. That is the, I think, most stimulative, or I should say least destructive way to increase taxes if you're going
to. So here's
to
the
two
Tim plan is we eliminate loopholes and raise.
No,
the,
okay, you eliminate loopholes, you add
new.
Damn,
I thought I had you there for a second.
No, I'll let you add new brackets on the top or do whatever you want, but I want to fix the ratio in place between the top brackets and the lower brackets. What I think is despicable is when politicians, A, sort of nickel and dime taxes, oh, well, a little bit of soda tax here, a little bit of gas tax there, a little bit of cigarette tax there, and then when they demagogue on class warfare. Is it right or is it wrong for people making $1 million to pay 10 times the rate of people earning $20,000?
Well, my response to that is I'll fix the ratio. I'll agree to fixing the ratio of the top bracket to the bottom bracket in how we tax them if you'll agree to fixing the ratio top incomes to bottom incomes.
But I think that's kind of a tall order. You can keep adding brackets on top. I mean, you can have brackets going up to $10 million as far as I care. But the fact of the matter is that I think that what I want by fixing the ratio is that in the future, every time we have to raise taxes, everybody's taxes would go up, say, 1% or 2%. And every time we were going to cut taxes, everybody's taxes would go down proportionally.
But
I'm fixing it in – I'm letting you make it be a progressive tax code. And saying, because what you're doing is this weird
ratchet. You just won't let it become a more progressive tax code over time.
Yeah, what you're doing is this weird ratchet where you're saying, oh, we need more money, raise taxes on the rich. Oh, we have a surplus, cut taxes on the poor. And it goes back and forth, and the curve just gets steeper and steeper. And when it comes to income taxes, the Bush tax cuts made it effectively a steeper curve because it was a bigger proportional cut for the lower brackets than it was for the upper brackets. All in all. And so then Obama's tax hike then makes it a steeper curve. And it just keeps getting steeper and steeper because it's politically easy to to sell tax hikes on the rich. And part of that, you would point out, is, well, you know, nobody really feels bad for the guy making over $500,000. Fine, sell America on a bunch of brackets up top, but stop the sort of future demagoguery and fix the ratio in place. So you move the whole curve up or down in unison. I think that would be better for our politics.
Of course, we still have some disagreements, but I think we should, as we say in Washington, staff it out. Okay. I'll have my people talk to your people.
Yes.
First, I need to get some people, though. Do you have any people?
Do I have people? Yes, I have three children.
So okay. I've got a dog over here on my couch. Maybe he can. Do you have a dog?
No dog. But my son does a very good dog impression. But we were talking about 1986, so our final topic we'll address quickly is why you think Ronald Reagan is an underrated president. Is that correct?
No, I don't think Ronald Reagan is an underrated president. Christopher Hitchens thinks. Hitchens has an interesting piece that he put up on Slate where he rips into Reagan viciously for about five paragraphs and then gets all sentimental at the end and says, mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad Reagan was president.
Yeah.
And my version of that would not include the final paragraph. No, I think Reagan was a lousy president. I'm not one of these liberals who's going around trying to persuade everybody like Eugene Robinson is in the Post today that I am the true heir to Ronald Reagan. Of course I'm not the true heir to Ronald Reagan. I'm a liberal.
Yes.
You know, maybe I'm a true heir to the Ronald Reagan of, you know, 1946, but I'm not a true heir to the Ronald Reagan of 1981.
Just a quick note. I have a headline that I think all editors should have on hand for column, which is, that dead person everybody is revering right now would have agreed with my policy prescriptions.
Right.
that's what the Eugene Robinson thing is. I've seen that every angle about Reagan. You see it about every person who, if they're widely enough liked, say, well, Martin Luther King actually would have agreed with me on whether we should tax carried interest.
But right. Now, what is true is that the actual policies that were enacted in his presidency were far less conservative than is generally supposed. Mm-hmm. That is not a glimpse into Ronald Reagan's soul. That's a glimpse into the politics of the time.
Yeah.
Although I think you are glimpsing into Ronald Reagan's soul when you look at the deficit. I think he truly did not care about the deficit. When Grover Norquist went on his campaign to name everything in the world after Ronald Reagan, I wrote that my bid was to name the deficit after Reagan. We could call it Reagan. give me back my airport and call the deficit the Reagan is my position on that.
I think Obama might own it more than Reagan now. So.
Well,
so in 1999, you were right.
We might have to start calling it the Obama if things don't start to change.
But see, I agree with you, and I think because where Ronald Reagan, when he, you know, was talking to the Soviets and calling them the evil empire, the Democrats freaked out. Well, first of all of Europe freaked out. They thought that was horrible and barbaric. And Tom Foley said, oh, the real evil resides in the White House, or Tip O'Neill, actually. The real evil resides in the White House. So there's this pretend thing where, oh, well, everybody, because when it came to the actual Cold War and, you know, the Soviet Union, there was lots of bipartisan agreement about the Soviet Union were the bad guys and we were the good guys. But when it came to the way Reagan wanted to fight it, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. That was not greeted across the board with the cheers that it was greeted with out in at the Brandenburg Gate. A lot of Democrats didn't like that. When they said, what's your approach to the Cold War? He said, here it is. We win, they lose. And that sort of attitude, which I think was very important to our winning the Cold War, was not a bipartisan attitude.
I have to say, I disagree. I first of all, I think they're all Democrats, inwardly were cheering Reagan when he said, tear down that wall. The disagreement was whether it was a prudent thing to say, whether it was overly provocative. But there wasn't anybody in the United States who didn't want the Berlin Wall to come down.
Sure. No, I meant to lump it in with the we win, you lose, and the evil empire talk, and that they didn't want, and there were some people who didn't think we were going to beat communism. Maybe they were mostly in academia, but Young America's Foundation puts out this poster. It says, he said it and no one believed him. It's got Reagan saying, you know, communism, ash heap of history, surrounded by all these liberal academics and politicians saying, it's ridiculous. We have to learn how to coexist with the Soviet Union.
But, so you know, when you look at the record, thing. Reagan is not, you know, there's an awful lot of self-serving historical analysis that says, oh, Reagan knew that Russia was going to, you know, implode. You know, you can find statements supporting that view by Reagan. You can find statements supporting the precise opposite view as well. So I don't think Reagan had any special knowledge about the fate of the Soviet Union.
Well, I think he had an optimism and a belief. I mean, and it's tricky because I'm the kind of guy who, about Islamic terrorism, I say, you can't win that war. This war will never be over. I don't even know how we win Afghanistan or Iraq. So I'm sounding, you know, un-Reagan-esque because I think it's a different war that we're fighting today. But there were a lot of people who sounded about the Cold War the way I did. I remember just looking. I did an article on this for the American Spectator when Reagan died, about the Evil Empire speech and the sort of reaction it got among liberal columnists, Mary McGrory, among in Europe, and it was mocked on the floor of Congress at the time. And there was not the optimism that we are just going to go, and to use Bill Clinton's words, we just have to win. That wasn't a sort of shared idea.
Right, but Eric Honecker didn't respond to that speech by saying, oh boy, we better take down that wall. I mean, I don't think that the speech's impact on events was significant. I think that what happened was that the Soviet Union was in an advanced state of collapse, and you know, I don't think the United States won the Cold War. I think that the Russians lost it.
And I wish I had more of these quotes on hand, but I feel like this is horrible way to cheat Reagan at both ends, where ahead of time he was told, no, you can't just go and beat them. And then once we beat them, he says, oh, well, they were going to collapse anyway. It's a way that happens to conservatives all the time, where they can't win. And there were people, I mean, I'm agreeing with your original premise. Ronald Reagan was not sort of loved bipartisan. He did not sort of share some great, you know, moderate centrist idea that spanned all sides. He was a conservative, well, I won't say fiscal conservative because you mentioned the deficit. He was a tax cutter, and he believed in cutting regulations. And he believed that the United States, because of its freedom, was better and would beat the Soviet Union, and that it was going to take a military buildup to do that. And these were issues that half of the Washington establishment disagreed with.
And the judgment of historians who've looked at this is the military buildup. Our military buildup had very little to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Look, it was a long time coming, and where I will credit Reagan is that he was able to recognize, as Margaret Thatcher was, that Gorbachev represented change, mm-hmm. genuine change, and I will give him that. But I think it falls more into the category of he didn't blow it, rather than he affirmatively did very much.
Well, that's very,
that
very kind
of
you. The
advocacy of Star Wars was particularly weighed, particularly.
No, but I mean, you look at his arms control stuff and the seeing Gorbachev. Part of the other caricature of him, and this is used by critics of him and by, you know, neoconservative people trying to deify him and advance their own ideology, is the idea that he was this constant hawk. He did have, you know, three actual engagements. He did Grenada and these other things. But the embrace of Gorbachev and the doing the arms control, as well as, you know, doing the Star Wars stuff, that he was hawkish when he thought that was the right thing to do. And he was dovish and about...
That's absolutely correct. His bark was a lot worse than his bite on hawkishness, and the country definitely benefited from that. So I will make that.
Yeah, and I'll recommend a column in my paper, The Washington Examiner, by Gene Healy. It was Reagan was no neocon. Now again, this fits into that dead person that everyone is praising would have agreed with my particular policies. It is one of those columns, and I don't agree.
He had a neocon point. Phase. I think Iran-Contra was his neocon phase.
Yeah,
he outgrew it. He outgrew it by almost getting impeached for it. All presidents outgrow their neocon phases. George W. eventually outgrew his, too.
George
it's
W.
a developmental
grew into
stage in conservative presidents. To
George W. grew into his hawkishness. Do you remember the second debate between Bush and Gore?
Right, where he mocked the idea of
nation building.
That was the
first time I felt enthusiastic about George W. Bush. But as we know, 9/11 changed everything.
By those last couple of years, the neocons were on the outs.
Yes.
Rumsfeld kind of blew it for them.
Yes.
Rumsfeld and others. I think we've covered the waterfront here.
We've solved Egypt and ISA and Reagan. So I think that's a good day.
And we've established. So we just to be clear, neither of us is the true heir to Ronald Reagan. Is that right?
No. But I think I'm pretty close, but not quite.
Well, you're a lot closer than I am.
Thank you, Tim.
But I hereby pledge on Blocking Heads, I will never in my life claim to be the true heir to Ronald Reagan that Ronald Reagan was a liberal. On that note, this has been fun talking.
Been fun talking.
Let's do it again sometime.
All right. Bye.